Marcy, what was the last time you remember failing at something?
Oh, it's so regular, I can't even give you the details.
Did you learn anything from your failure?
Well, I learned that they call it a learning experience just to cheer you up.
You know, I try to remember that, but the pain is too much, and it's hard to think about moving ahead.
Well, I try to remember that the key to success is fun, and failing can hurt. It can. According to journalist and author Megan McArdle, failing and pain of failure are good for us.
Megan McArdle's new book is called The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. Do you know that we can fail well, Marcy?
I never thought of it that way.
Well, we should probably listen to this interview our esteemed colleague Steve Scherr did with Megan McArdle.
I mean this in the best possible way. This is a book of aphorisms. If at first you don't succeed, try again. If you fall, pick yourself up, start all over again, learn from your mistakes. Failure is an option. That's the one answer that isn't part of it.
Well, I mean, you know, this is true that the eternal truths of the human condition are not novel. But it helps to look at case studies and to see it made live. Because I don't know about you, but the experience that I've had a lot is that I will go through some experience, I will screw it up, I will learn the lesson, I will get better. Then I will look back and say, oh, right, my parents were trying to tell me that when I was 16. And so, you know, that's what this book is about. It's about looking at case studies and learning how to handle failure better.
Good judgment comes from experience. Experience comes from bad judgment.
It's absolutely true. Sadly true. We wish that we could learn just by looking at other people. And sometimes you can, but in fact, most of life's great lessons are learned the hard way. They're learned by trying and falling down.
The hunter-gatherers and the farmers.
Yes.
I guess I could have used the ant and the grasshopper again as another effort.
Well, the foragers and the farmers, this was one of the most interesting things that I discovered, in part because it was serendipitous. I was going out to this lab. I was going to look at experimental economics, and I started talking to an anthropologist that was working on one of the experiments, and I realized there's something really fundamental and important here about the way that we think about risk. So there's a stereotype of hunter-gatherers in the battle days as nobles, as savages who, you know, Hobbesian war of all against all. And it turns out that's not true. In fact, hunter-gatherers cooperate a lot more than most people. They share a lot of the groups, although it varies by group, a lot of them come pretty close to sort of true communism, or at least the kind of true communism that you see in a family. And then when they settle down and become agricultural, that seems to change. Hunter-gatherer groups, there's no hierarchy, there's no status hierarchy, there's no I'm better than you. It's completely flat, and they very communal. And then agriculture comes, and somehow we turn into status-oriented, status-obsessed, really, and very possessive about property. And interestingly, this is what chimps are like, too. They're bad at cooperating, and they're very status-oriented. So why is this different? And it turns out this anthropologist, Hilly Kaplan, has a theory that these are different ways of handling risk. When you are hunting in a group or by yourself, you can be very skilled, and if there isn't an animal there, you're still not going to bag anything. And there's a limit to how good you can be at tracking and so forth if you don't come across tracks. And so what the sharing is a way to manage the risk. It's a very risky. Some days you get a bear, some days you get the bear, and then some days you get nothing. And you may have 30,000 calories worth of food or zero. And so you share with other people in order to spread the risk around. When you're in agriculture, there's more of a direct line between input and output. I plant and then I sow. And so what Kaplan had done was actually track a tribe. He'd gone and visited a tribe. It was in the process of transitioning from the forest to agriculture, and watched how their morals changed about sharing over time, how their norms evolved towards what we think of as the normal agricultural. And so when you think about when someone's failed, you can think about it like a farmer, like they didn't do what they were supposed to. Or you can think about it like a forager, is the world's risky, and sometimes you can try as hard as you want, and you're not going to get the right outcome. And how you think about it makes a big difference in how you treat it and what sort of society you end up having.
The idea is, this book, and the idea of embracing risk and embracing failure, is that stuff happens, and we should be prepared for it, but not be afraid of it.
Exactly. Is that first of all, failure is going to happen. If you're doing anything new, then you are going to fail, because failure is what happens when you're doing something you don't know how to do. But also that, you know, we tend to place too much emphasis on the person and the outcome. So we look at if someone doesn't wash their hands, you can kill a patient 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000 times. But because we don't see it, we actually don't spend a lot of time penalizing healthcare providers for not washing their hands. We spend a lot of time penalizing them if a baby is born with cerebral palsy, even though they may not have had any control over that. We need to focus more on good processes, but that I think that the hunt for who did this deliberately and was evil and made this happen is the wrong focus. The right focus is the system was vulnerable, and we were all led to believe that it was less vulnerable than it was. How do we fix that?
What do we learn from video games about these ideas?
Well, the best thing about video games, from my perspective anyway, from the perspective of this book, is that video games came up early on with a way to make failure less costly. So those of us who are a certain age will remember that video games in the arcade that you used to play when you were a kid, you would just go through endless just grinding out levels that were always pretty much the same. You had to learn these very complicated patterns. But it could take 3 hours to get to the point where you would then lose. And then you would have to go and start over and over and over again. And of course, so naturally, the only people who managed to master these video games were teenage boys who had a lot of time and also this kind of monomaniacal obsession with winning. So what they started to do was they started to introduce save points. And so now what video games do is you can easily go back to right before the place where you screwed it up. And then you can just practice that instead of going back and having to start all the way over. And that's actually how you want to think of failure in general. As a society, you don't want to encourage people to take crazy risks. You do want to encourage people to have good processes like washing your hands every single time you touch a patient. However, once a failure has happened, you want to make that failure, it should hurt, because that's how nature tells us to stop doing that. It doesn't work. But the pain should be of a specific kind, short, sharp, and encouraging you to move on and try again rather than incredibly painful so that a lot of people just give up, just don't even try.
Or in your analogy to education, you're really smart. You did really good work. You're so smart. Or I see how hard you worked. Teaches me two different lessons.
Absolutely. So this is one of the things that was hit the closest to home for me, is that I was one of those kids who, like a lot of writers, I did pretty well in English class all the way through. The problem is you get to the big leagues and everyone was the best person in their English class. Everyone was the star reporter on their college paper and so forth. And suddenly you start worrying, what if I'm not good enough? And what you end up doing is then just procrastinating endlessly because you're afraid of what will happen when you finally put pen to paper if it's not very good. And everyone writes things that aren't very good. Many first drafts are just absolutely dreadful. And so I had to teach myself over a long period of time that I had to say, it's okay. I accept that what I'm about to write may not be very good, but I can make it better once I've written it. I can rewrite garbage. I can't rewrite nothing. And that's a lesson a lot of writers have to teach themselves. And I talked to a psychologist named Carol Dweck, who does research on people who are good at facing challenges and people who aren't. So the people who are good at it have what you call a growth mindset. They're people who they think of trying and even failing as they're learning. They're teaching their brain something. Then you have what are called people with a fixed mindset, and this is absolutely me, is people who think that a challenge is like a dipstick. It just measures a given level of talent. The good news is that you can change. And she said, I confessed to her that I had a fixed mindset. She said, me too, but she changed. And in the course of writing this book, I realized I really changed myself. And I'm much more willing to try things that I'm not good at and enjoy trying things that I'm not good at. Because I know that this is how I'm expanding my skill set and how I, you know, maybe discovering something I didn't know I liked to do before.
You say that what we have here is the culmination of your willingness to take those risks and make some bad judgments and good judgments. But back to video games, since we're talking about risk, but managing risk, understanding that the world is a dangerous place, but that we can do some things to be careful. What did video games teach you about managing relationships?
A lot of things. Surprisingly, one of the things it taught me is that we tend to see intention where it isn't really there, right? We tend to think of, I will humanize when I'm playing a video game. Both my husband and I play video games. And what I realized, I walked in one night and saw him yelling at his video game console, and he said, "This racist goon is saying terrible things about elves, and I am an elf." And of course, I love my husband very much, and he's not an elf. But you know, we tend to personalize.
Not in this world.
Not in this world. And the, but he identified very strongly with his elf, and this is how we are with the people around us. Is that in fact we tend to assume that from what we can see, we have these very powerful little units in our brain, you might call them modules in our brain, that are programmed to look for intent. And we see it even when it's not there. And so we see people doing things and we don't think about, well, what if I can't imagine what they're thinking? We assume that we can infer from exactly what they're doing. And the example I always give is that, you know, I supported the Iraq War in 2003, which was a very bad decision. And I supported it because I was sure that Saddam Hussein had WMD. And I was sure that he had WMD because he was acting like I would have if I had a nuclear bomb, right? And the problem is I was not the dictator of a large Middle Eastern oil-rich nation, right? I wasn't thinking, oh, you know, probably he has a lot of concerns that I don't even know about. And probably he doesn't really act exactly the way that a journalist living in New York City acts. And so you overestimate your ability to tell what people are thinking, and you overread intention where it isn't there. And that has been, you know, I learned that first from my complete inability to let things go when a computer artificial intelligence attacks me. I just can't let it, you know, I'm not going to teach them anything, but somehow I have to really destroy them to prove, to show them that they really shouldn't have done that. Everything from that to, you know, to go back to, I will say, to forgiveness is realizing, you know what, it's often cheaper just to start over.
Yeah, that's a tough one. You know, you also explode a myth, and I guess that follows along with what we're talking about. So I'll end with this story. So Van Halen. And we had always heard, I had always heard, the myth was Van Halen, these rockers, you know, they stick in a rider in their contract that says brown M&Ms. What a bunch of egotistical buttheads. They want brown M&Ms in their green room. But it was about understanding and managing failure and risk.
Yeah, absolutely. It was no brown M&Ms.
No brown M&Ms. Excuse me. I had a thing to...
Every contract had a line that said, we need a bowl of M&Ms with no brown ones. And this was taken for years as signs that they were just hopeless prima donnas who were just demanding things because they could. Here's the thing. Van Halen had this incredibly complicated show with all of this immense equipment and light shows and so forth. And it was dangerous. I mean, if you didn't do something right, you could set the stage on fire, you could kill someone with falling equipment and so forth. And what they wanted to do was make sure that management was taking care. They had very specific instructions. It was laid out in this multi-hundred page contract. Wanted to make sure that management was reading the entire thing and doing exactly what they were told, because if they didn't, it was too dangerous for them to play.
Life and death.
Yes. So what they did was they stuck in the middle, like section 122 of the contract said, and we want a bowl of M&Ms with no brown ones in the dressing room. And when they walked in and they didn't see the bowl of M&Ms with no brown ones, what they knew was that management had not been reading the contract carefully, that they would not have been taking, that the venue had not taken adequate care with the rest of the show, and that therefore they wouldn't go on. It was their way. It was a little error checking system to make sure that management was as committed to doing it right as they were.
Megan McArdle's new book is The Upside of Down: Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. She spoke to our esteemed colleague, Steve Scheer.